Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. If you're listening via our new Radio Plus iPhone app, did you know you can get detailed information about a stock by simply touching its symbol on the crawling stock ticker? If you don't have the Radio Plus iPhone app yet, you'll want to download it. It's free via the iTunes App Store.
John Riding with us, some RDQ Economics. John, you look at inflation, it's beginning to percolate, this idea of disinflation. The gloom crew, those more cautious, really talking about a small bout of deflation. You push against that. If we have incredibly low nominal and real interest rates, shouldn't we have low inflation?
No, I think actually the reverse. We have negative real interest rates, even given the low inflation rates that we have, which I think are a temporary phenomenon coming from the decline in energy prices that we've seen and the decline in commodity prices. And that still gives us negative real interest rates, and negative real interest rates means the Fed's pumping more money into the system than the system needs.
When do we see the inflation that you and Alan Meltzer worry about?
I think it could still be a couple of years. But if the Fed were to jump in and do a QE3 bout, we could see what we saw last year. There was a very fast inflation response to QE2. QE2 was announced in the late part of 2010. And by early 2011, we had run rates on the CPI that were running at 5%. And then the Fed then said, oh, that's just commodity prices, core inflation's low. Well, now core inflation's up at around 2% and seems likely to be sustained. The difference between now and when inflation was low 2 or 3 years ago was core inflation was sub 1%. Now it seems to be entrenched at around 2%.
And that key word here is entrenched. It's almost like the word anchored, but it does mean something else. Is the central bank accommodative frenzy that we're seeing right now leading to an entrenched future inflation?
I think so. The difference possibly between myself and the Federal Reserve is many people welcome that idea that inflation expectations are, if you look at the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Inflation Index, we'll get one later on, we'll see an inflation expectations for the next 5 years around 3%.
That's out at 9:55 this morning. John, this is a pretty big miss. You know, the survey was off by half a point. Is it too soon to tell what everybody got wrong?
Obviously, I haven't seen the details of the numbers, but
we don't care. Just talk.
we obviously got gasoline price wrong. We saw yesterday a pretty big miss in the other direction with import prices, where import prices fell more than expected. So, trying to guess where exactly that number comes in when you get these huge swings in energy prices is a very difficult game. No doubt this miss will be caught up. We know gasoline prices low will be caught up next month.
This is a really important question, and within the blur of a beautiful July Friday here at our power breakfast at the Regency, the little secret this week are negative nominal rates. Switzerland, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 years out, negative interest rates. France, negative interest rates, etc. Can that carry over to your United Kingdom or to the United States? Could we see our 10-year yield come right down to where Germany is now or even lower?
Well, we have negative real rates already in the U.S. 10-year yields adjusted for inflation expectations are about negative 0.6%. But we have this, again, entrenched inflation expectation in the bond market of about 2% per year inflation over the next 10 years. That's where the bond market is. So I think negative 10-year yields, very unlikely. Negative short-term rates, it's potentially possible, but not very healthy.
John, macroeconomic advisors comes down to 1.2% run rate GDP. That's not good enough to get it done, is it?
It's not good enough, and it's not good enough from the perspective of the incumbent when it comes to November. The GDP over the first three quarters of this year is a very important predictor of election results. Interestingly, whereas campaign financing, which you just talked about, the Free Economics guys earlier this week were saying there is no evidence that how much money you raise has much of an influence on the outcome of elections, that campaign financing is way overrated, although it may be a good predictor because they say the funds go to the more attractive candidates. So weak GDP number funds coming in for Mitt Romney may be a predictor for the November elections.
What kind of economics does Governor Romney have? You are our arch, what we call neo-Vixalian economy. It's not supply side. It's different than Dean Hubbard up at Columbia. What kind, when you look at Republican economics, what flavor is Mitt Romney?
Well, I think you have to go with, in terms of where his advisors are placed. I mean, the one area where I strongly agree with Professor Hubbard is, and as he wrote when he left the Council of Economic Advisors when he was there, what lower tax rates on a broader base is possible. Now, the problem is, politically, you can't spell out how you broaden the tax base ahead of the elections, and that's the missing part of the plan. But we need to have a broader base and lower rates, pro-growth, raise more revenues, and I'm 100% in agreement with that.
You know, we just heard Brett Baer say that as he visits swing precincts and swing states, of course, the big topic is the economy. Do you see any signs that things will look better by Election Day, either in terms of economic growth or the unemployment rate?
No, but ironically, if everybody expects the tax rates to rise on January 1st, 2013, and that's a $400 to $500 billion tax hike that we will not address until December at the earliest, people will start accelerating income to beat the tax hike and record income this year. So the numbers could look better as the year comes to an end, precisely because people are trying to beat the tax increase, and that would then hollow out the first half of next year.
Not that many people have the opportunity to accelerate income. Could it possibly make up the difference?
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just simply saying that we may see some statistics. We saw it in the fourth quarter of 1992 ahead of President Clinton taking office. People accelerated income into the fourth quarter of 2002. And we saw it in the third quarter of 1992 and the third quarter of 2003, after Bush accelerated all the tax cuts into the second quarter, all of a sudden the income people were holding back would burst into life. But those are timing effects. It's not real stimulus. And the problem is that the only stimulus game is monetary policy, and monetary policy is completely tapped out.
John Riding with us with RDQ Economics, of course, for years with Bear Stearns. John, you, I think of David Blanchflower up at Dartmouth, maybe Adam Posen with the Peterson Institute, are the most uniquely qualified to understand transatlantic political economics. You lived with the Bank of England, lived with the Federal Reserve. You know about LIBOR cold. You've lived with the pressure of being at a firm like Bear Stearns where you're really worried about short-term paper. Is there a difference in the LIBOR debate in the city of London versus the debate on Wall Street in America, or is there no distinction across the ocean?
Well, I think that what the debate is about is outrage towards bankers. To me, the LIBOR is a non-scandal scandal. You have interest rates that were lower than would otherwise have been reported were in the fourth quarter of 2008, perhaps by a quarter of a percentage point. And so who was hurt? Borrowers were certainly not hurt. But we are angry at the banks for their manipulation of the rate, which they were doing out of self-preservation because it was policy to get LIBOR down. And it's outrage. And I think it tells us more. This tells us more about the attitude of people on both sides of the Atlantic to the bankers.
Mr. Diamond with a D exiting quickly at Barclays, is a more stringent or assertive London approach going to come over to New York, or do you really look at them culturally as two different entities?
Well, we're going to see it. And it's not just U.S. and U.K. banks. The 18 banks that set LIBOR, the 16 banks that were setting at the
Bank
time
of Tokyo, Mitsubishi
global,
as well.
Are global banks. Yeah. But it was public policy to get LIBOR down. And we're talking about a spread off an interest rate that was set by the Federal Reserve. So things that were done that were wrong, but my question is, who was hurt? Yes, swap counterparties, some people did better, some people did worse to the extent that rates were manipulated. But borrowers paid lower rates if they could borrow at all in the fourth quarter of 2008 as a result of this.
John Riding, thank you so much.
Thanks,
terrific
John.
Perspective, as always, with RDQ Economics.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York. or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.